As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
I'm not clear to that. No, Newport's the worst.
Yeah. Oh, Newport was horrific.
Brentford as well was pretty bad, wasn't it?
Well, Brentford.
There's loads of them. I've got a list
well, actually,
here as well.
It might be fifth worst. I'm writing down Sheffield United and Brentford.
Also, the West Brom 0-0, I think probably could have been a.
Would you know
could
what,
have gone after
I've
that.
Got, I've got West Brom 0-0 as the second worst.
Yeah.
Where does Brighton home rank?
It was going to be fourth, but I'd forgotten about Sheffield United and Brentford.
Hello and welcome to Pod on the Tyne, your go-to Newcastle United podcast brought to you by The Athletic. My name's Taylor Payne and coming up on this week's show, we'll be talking about the frankly disgusting performance at Brighton on Saturday night. Ryan Taylor relives his finest moment in black and white in the archive. It's the question on everyone's lips, why hasn't Steve Bruce been sacked yet? And as George has been jabbed and is a gibbering wreck after his trip to Brighton, Private Christopher Waffles and I will be joined for all of it by friend of the podcast and athletic scribe Michael Walker. Michael is sure to provide the kind of sunny optimism and carefree whimsy usually served up by Mr. Corgan. How are you doing, Michael? Are you well? It's been a while, mate.
Yes, carefree, I would describe myself.
Yes, I believe the last time you were on the podcast, I described you as effervescent as well.
Yes, there you go. Nothing's changed.
Outstanding. Nothing has changed, literally. Anyway, but before we get into that boiling cauldron of dog vomit, that was the Brighton game, I've got just enough time to remind you about the latest offer from The Athletic. You can subscribe to The Athletic UK right now for a special price of $3.99 a month for 6 months. That's 40% off the full price of a subscription. You'll enjoy great analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, as well as ad-free versions of all our podcasts. Chris, how are you, sir? You okay?
Well, it's 3 days on from Brighton, and George had to make the trip, and I didn't. Well, George chose to make the trip, so I'm not going to defend him in that sense. He elected to go all the way to Brighton to watch that. So
he knew what he was doing.
It was funny because on the way down, he called us just as he got to the outskirts of London. He's like, I sort of enjoyed this. This was sort of a change of scenery, and now I'm already bored already. And this was obviously several hours before the game itself. And he just called me at full time, and he sounded like a broken man.
Oh dear. Even more so than he usually does, which is impressive.
Exactly. Yeah. Just saying something.
So Chris, is there any specific articles or anything to watch out for this week coming from you?
Well, George and I did do a piece on the Brighton game, basically saying how it looked, smelt and felt like the end for Steve Bruce. But somehow here we are 3 days on later and it isn't the end. And we sort of put that in the article at the time. Because I think there was a lot of thoughts on Saturday that he would go, but obviously, that hasn't proved to be the case. So we're sort of just trying to explain what happened on Saturday. I tried to give insight into Steve Bruce's press conference and how he was similar or different to previous press conferences. And then also Ryan Taylor. Yeah, I spoke to Ryan Taylor last week for a Cult Heroes series that we've got run on The Athletic at the minute. Each club writer is speaking to or writing about a different cult hero from a club. And obviously, Over the Wall qualifies as that. So that will be up on The Athletic. I think it'll go up on Thursday. And obviously, we'll have part of that interview for listeners to hear a bit later on.
Excellent. Well, there you go. Get yourself onto theathletic.com/pod on the time to take advantage of the special 40% discount. That's theathletic.com/pod on the time. Well, chaps, we can't put it off any longer. We're going to have to talk about that Brighton game, I'm afraid. Lazy, uninspired, lackluster, the appearance of not caring, no fathomable tactical approach, no threat, no fight, no dynamism. Newcastle are playing like a team that's already been relegated, aren't they, Michael?
Well, I actually don't know if you can say they're playing like a team that's already been relegated, but they're playing like a team that's on its way to relegation. It was the lack of ambition is, you know, has been evident at times in other games, but I think to the wider watching world as well, it was pretty striking that here was the Saturday night entertainment, and this is what Newcastle were offering. It was so passive, and just flat, and yet, you know, there were moments where they almost got away with it. You know, it was like, you know, George was talking about hanging on from kickoff, and that's what it felt like. And but if Fraser's shot goes in, you know, it might have changed things. It might have been, you know, they might have clung on to get a point. But as Chris said in last week's podcast, that lack of ambition is really striking, because if you don't go to Brighton and try to win, and if you don't go to West Brom and try to win,
exactly,
then where are you going to go to try to win? Mm-hmm. And that is, to me, that is the, in terms of the team and the tactical setup of the team, that's the biggest issue. Obviously, the biggest issue at the club is the overall ownership structure, et cetera, that we've known a long time. But in 2021, the team's biggest issue is that passivity and just that, you know, it's just so passive.
It is. And Chris, they didn't even lay a glove on Brighton, did they? Apart from that Ryan Fraser effort that hit the post, there was very little to shout about, and I'm not even sure if they registered an actual shot on target, did they?
Well, apparently the stats did give them one in the end, because it would have been they wouldn't have had a shot on target, either home or away, against Brighton. But I think it was the 75th minute. It wasn't really a shot, but it counted as one. I think Isaac Hayden trying to head the ball across goal in the first half, but actually heading it out of play, also counted as a shot, not a shot on target. But
if you hit the woodwork, that should count as a shot on target. I don't like that rule.
Is it on the target though? I don't know if that's not the target.
Yeah, but it's really
the target
good.
Isn't the post?
It's really good hitting the post, though, isn't it?
Yeah. If the ball hits the post,
it's a really good noise, and
if it hits the post and goes in,
it's generally the sign of a good shot.
Yeah, if it hits the post and goes in, is that a shot on target and off target? Do you get one of each?
Well, yeah, there you go.
You should do, but yeah, I mean, Newcastle again playing with this split strikerless, you know, false nine, false football team kind of approach that they have at the minute. You don't see where the goals are going to come from, do you, Chris? It's just sort of. There's so little energy and so little dynamism in that team at the minute. I'm not really sure where it's going to come from.
No, you don't see where the goals are going to come from. And when Michael talks about how passive they were, that's right. And what is perhaps most alarming is that my understanding is that what Steve Bruce wanted Newcastle to do was to press high and to really try and get up Brighton in that sense and try and win the ball high up the pitch. And we saw absolutely none of that. So whatever instructions were given didn't come through in the game itself. And when they first changed to this formation, and also when they played relatively well at home against Liverpool, albeit Liverpool still should have scored a few goals, it was about this high intensity. They were pressing higher up the pitch. They were trying to do that. And that's completely gone now. And Almiron was important. He's so important to that side. And I can understand why Steve Bruce wanted to get him back into the team. But he didn't look 100% fit, and that was hard to actually judge because Newcastle had so little of the ball from actually doing anything with. But there's just no chemistry between the front three and what they're trying to do, and there is no focal point for Newcastle to work off. And I just don't understand the system in that sense. Is that it's not if you're Liverpool and you have three forwards who can all move around and can all do different things and create all those problems, then I sort of get it. But Newcastle had three players on the pitch whose goal-scoring records, Almiron's is the best of them, but it isn't brilliant. Joe Linton averages one in every 33 games or whatever. Ryan Fraser hasn't scored for Newcastle yet. It's just... And it beggars belief that if you've got two strikers on the bench, at what point are you going to bring them on if you're not going to bring them on when you're 2-3-0 down?
Yeah.
Why are they even on the bench? Because... if you're not going to change system at that point, then they may as well not have been in the squad.
Michael, do Andy Carroll and Dwight Gayle have a case to feel aggrieved here? Should they be getting the chance? I mean, they're not the greatest players in the world, but they do carry a goal threat, don't they?
I think Dwight Gayle deserves a chance, you know.
Yeah.
I think Andy Carroll may have had his chance. You know, he has had chances. You know, didn't he, whenever I was, didn't he play at Newport? Which to me is the worst performance of the season. You know, so I don't know if he's got a reasonable case, but just the Dwight Gayle probably needs minutes to get match fitness, and he hasn't had many. And you would just have him even for 45 minutes in the second half. Take Joe Linton off. Just sort of say, accept that hasn't worked as a club. Accept that hasn't worked, and take him off and give Gayle a spell and see if he can generate something on his own, because as a formation, it wasn't going to work, but he might be able to generate something on his own and he might be able to excite those around him. And actually, if you think about it, theoretically, Fraser, Almiron, Gayle is quite a mobile front three. And if your idea is to get on top of Brighton as they play the ball out from the back, then that's not, theoretically, that's not a bad idea. But you have to have mobility in that, and you have to have, as Chris says, energy, but you also have to have that chemistry you mentioned. And that sort of commitment to doing it together. And so what you have is Almiron, you know, pressing on his own, then looking over his shoulder, you know, with his sad eyes at the fact that no one else is supporting him. And I completely understand them. You know, it's just like, you know, he's isolated and he's trying to do a one man press.
Yeah. He looks like, you know, when you pretend to throw a ball for a dog and then you don't throw it and the dog looks at you and it's not got anger in its eyes. It's got disappointment and sadness. That's how Miguel Almiron looks at the minute when he's not getting backed up by the rest of his team. I mean, Chris, in my opinion, I don't know how you feel about this, but based on those current performances and the body language of the players and all that sort of stuff, I'm really worried that if we go into that bottom three, that's it. I don't see us getting back out of it. From a mindset point of view, I just don't know if the players are strong enough to pull us up and out of that position. What do you think of that?
That would be my fear as well. I mean, actually, as far back as just after the Sheffield United game, when George and I did a piece together on sort of the issues in Newcastle, I spoke to someone in and around the dressing room, and there's a quote within that piece basically saying almost that, as if Newcastle drop in to the bottom three, at that point, I think there were still 10 points clear, but if Newcastle drop into the bottom three, they didn't think there was the fight or the confidence within them to really come out from that. And that's at the moment, the only reason Newcastle aren't in the bottom three is because Fulham haven't been able to pick up enough points. They've picked up some to really close that gap. But basically, Fulham not winning on Friday has kept Newcastle from being out of the bottom three. If you look at the bottom five teams in the Premier League, I'd say Newcastle are in the bottom three of them at the moment in terms of the way that they're playing, and certainly in terms of results, 2 wins and 20 in all competitions, 2-18 in the Premier League, lack of goals.
Frightening, isn't it?
It is absolutely frightening, and I think that if they were to drop into it, the only positive I could take from that is maybe if there isn't the realization of the problem that they're in now, then suddenly that would spike a reaction from them. But I've seen no evidence to suggest that would be the case. And there's still what I found defeatist about Steve Bruce on Saturday is, whereas we've had in the previous weeks, he's talked about, oh, when we get our big players fit. Yet when he spoke about Sam Maximan and Wilson on Saturday, he said, yeah, it would be good to have them back. But when they do come back, you know, they've been out with muscle injuries, it could be a while, almost suggesting that he doesn't necessarily think that even if they come back straight after the international break, they're going to be ready. And that for me was a concern, because he had basically placed so much importance on those two coming back. I think too much importance, because I actually think it's been exaggerated, certainly Saint-Maximin-wise, how important he's actually been this season. But that, to me, sounded like a man who himself is starting to run out of ideas.
And I mean, the injury thing's interesting, isn't it? Because now we go into the next, the last portion of the season as well without Isaac Hayden, who picked up a nasty injury, with an accidental collision, which apparently has damaged his knee quite badly and is probably going to be out for the rest of the season, if not struggling to make it for the start of next season. But I mean, the injuries aside, Michael, we weren't playing particularly well before these players got injured either, and we weren't picking up points then. So is injuries a valid excuse here? Has Steve Bruce got a leg to stand on when it comes to injuries?
Yeah, he does, I think, yeah. I think the injuries to Wilson in particular. I know what Chris is saying about Alan Saint-Maximin, and I would have agreed with him 12 months ago, but I actually think Saint-Maximin's got better this season, and I think he's... Whenever he's on the pitch, he's improved. He's done the hardest thing, which is create chances. And so he has contributed that. And I think he is a big loss, a bigger loss than I would have said, as I say, a year ago or even 6 months ago. That, you know, so I do think there is an argument to be put that those two players do make a significant difference. However, you know, it's what's behind them has to improve. You know, that's what, you know, it's like there's a as you say, a lack of dynamism in midfield. So there needs to be that kind of energy brought into the midfield to try and support those. But it's all very well, this idea in modern football, in quotation marks, that the attackers have to do all, you know, are the start of the defence. Mm. But the attackers can't do everything.
Yeah.
I mean, you're asking them to defend and create and score.
Yeah.
What do the rest of the team do?
That's what kind of what Miguel Mirón brings, doesn't he? He gives you that kind of that press and he never stops running.
Yeah.
But you know, you can't expect that of that entire front three, because they're not those type of players. I agree with what you're saying about Saint-Maximin, actually, and I find it interesting. I think he's become more of a team player, hasn't he? And a bit less of an individual trying to kind of show his skill and his ability, and has actually become more of a team player. The setting up of that goal for Joe Willock as well on his debut, I thought was an example of that.
Yeah.
Just on Joe Willock, Chris, this is an interesting one, isn't it? Because he came into the team looking like a really fresh, energetic young lad who had a point to prove, who really wanted to make something of his time here, scored a goal in his debut, of course, and his first couple of performances were great. But he seems to have dropped off as well, doesn't he? And I mean, is it the malaise of playing within that midfield that's causing that? Or is it the system that he's been forced to play? And he's playing kind of wide on the left at the minute, isn't he? It's strange.
I thought he played quite well against Wolves in part. I thought he's possibly the second half the best player. I think that the concern for me with Willock is Miguel Arteta basically had to convince him to come to Newcastle and try to sell him this idea that it was good for his development. And he must be 2 months on thinking, oh my
God, what have I done?
He's also gone from a team, it plays in a completely different way. Arsenal do try to start from the back. They do try to build forward from midfield. And on the occasions when Willock's been able to do that and carry the ball, I think he's looked good. And I do think he brings something a little bit different to the midfield. But I feel for him because, yeah, as you say, he's been now shunted into this position, which in theory should suit him a little bit, but I just think that the balance of the team is all wrong and he suffers because of that. I think the fullbacks get exposed because the midfielders are expected to cover back. The forwards almost getting each other's way with the midfielders being a bit further out wide. I just don't think there is any balance there at all. And so Willock, he's still only 21 years of age and he's come into a team. He's come from a team who albeit Arsenal haven't been as good over the last couple of years, they're still used to winning. Certainly the majority of his games were in the Europa League. He was used to being in a team that would have more possession and that would tend to win games or at least be on the front foot. And he's had to completely try and change the way that he plays. And I think he has suffered because of that.
He's a good player and he's better than I thought he was at Arsenal. But it sort of feels that he needs to be more central and to be given a bit more, you know, freedom, but a bit more importance in the team that he needs to be essential to the middle of the team. You know, that's you get that impression from him that he would do well at that.
Is there someone who needs to make way in order for that to happen, though? I mean, you know, we've had our conversations about John Joe Shelvey in the past. I don't think he's playing to the level that we expect of him.
No, I've defended him on here before.
Yeah.
But if you had, for example, if you had Willock and Matty Longstaff or Sean Longstaff, playing centrally instead of Hayden, who will be out, and Shelvey, then there's not loads of experience, but there should be loads of energy.
Yeah.
And that would be, you know, whenever you're thinking about Tottenham, Newcastle just have to improve, yeah, and they have to improve in some way. And if all they can do is improve in terms of physical energy, then that's something, you know. But they can't bring Tottenham to St James's Park and sit back.
No,
you know, that's been proven not to work. You know, but they need them to be able to impose themselves in some kind of way. So if they have a bit of running power in the middle of the park, then that might aid that. I know it's not the most sophisticated of tactics or whatever, but at least it enables you to have some kind of rhythm in the middle of the pitch.
Yeah, I think it's time to move on now, but I think Newcastle need to sort themselves out ahead of Tottenham. We've got 2 weeks now break, almost 2 weeks, sorry, and apparently the team have been given a few days off to improve their mental and physical well-being, according to the club, and we shall see what happens next.
Can I just jump in on that point in terms of the optics of it are terrible, but what I will say is I know for a fact that other clubs are doing likewise during this international break. It's not atypical, given the schedule that there's been, given the intensity of this season compared to previous seasons, that you would have the number of days off they've got. So they were off Sunday, Monday. Then they're going to be off Friday till Monday, or at least are scheduled to be at the minute.
Yeah.
Now, what I mean by the optics of it is terrible is I do think some players expected to be back in on Monday. Yeah. I think that they thought they were going to be in, even if it was for a video nasty session or whatever. I think they thought there was going to be a change in exactly what was happening during this schedule. And in that sense, given everything that's going on, I can understand why people are annoyed and why things should change. But equally, I do also understand the sort of mental and physical arguments. I know people will sort of go, oh, but it isn't as straightforward as that, as just say it, as just dismissing. I do think there is a little bit more to it than that.
I agree with you, Chris. I think that everybody needs a break. Everybody needs a break from football in a way, you know, and we all, even us watching it, could do with a few days off it. And so the players need that as well. I just think I don't think that's the worst decision ever, you know. The question is what they do whenever they return to the training ground. And the bigger question is whether the training ground is a happy environment, because that's their workplace. That's where they, you know, it's not St. James's Park. That's where they go every day. And that, if you're not in a nice working environment or one that you're happy to be in, then that can't be conducive to improvement.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
It's a good position this for Newcastle. August 2011, let me take you back. A sunny August day. Newcastle United 1, Sunderland 0. Ryan Taylor writes himself into Newcastle United folklore.
Down, which is Stephen Taylor. Amiobi waiting to, and Mignolet is beaten! Newcastle United lead in the Weir Tyne derby. Stephen Taylor closed in, but did the ball sail all the way in?
Well, it's a fabulous effort from Ryan Taylor, but I just wondered about Mignolet's starting position here. He was so far towards his near post. And I think he more or less offered Ryan Taylor the back post.
Was it Taylor or was it Taylor?
Well, does it matter? I think the goalkeeper's positioning has to be questioned there. Look at his starting position. So far towards the front post, ends up underneath it. Well, I'm not convinced Stephen Taylor gets anything on it. Either way, it's a beautiful free kick from Ryan Taylor. Just wraps the inside of his right foot around this. And look at the action he gets on it.
Well, how many times did Ryan Taylor score from free kicks like that against Newcastle? Now he's scored for Newcastle. He claims it. And they lead at Sunderland.
Well, there you are. Hairs on the back of the neck. Absolute. I mean, I was there that day. I was in the away end that afternoon, and I think I've still got the scars for the post goal celebrations. It was quite astonishing. And Chris, I don't know if you remember this, a young up and coming manager, English by the name of Steve Bruce, was in charge of Sunderland that day as well.
He was indeed, yeah. And it was, I think, is this the last time Newcastle won the derby? Is that right?
No, that's, yeah, I think it is, yeah.
Yeah. So this is the stretch of wins that they had a succession. I mean, obviously the previous season they won 5-1 at home on Halloween, and they had a good run, and then subsequently, and I think this is probably one of the reasons why this has gone down so much in sort of folklore, yeah. and why Ryan Taylor certainly does qualify as a culture hero. I mean, he's got his song, he's got everything that's come with that, and the fact that he scored against Sunderland. But I think that because unfortunately it is now bordering on a decade since Newcastle actually won one of these games, then that was, and it was a huge moment. It decided the match, so that's why it was so huge.
It was a massive moment, and Ryan Taylor was playing left back in a team at the time under Alan Pardew, and keeping David Santon out of the team. I know there was a few of my friends and other fans who were complaining about the fact that a supposedly classy and attacking left back like David Santon was being kept out of the team by a workman like utility player like Ryan Taylor. But he's described this as being one of his best moments in a Newcastle United shirt, and it really was, wasn't it?
Yeah, he spoke about how the week before was the first time he'd ever played left back. So Newcastle sold Jose Enrique quite late in the window.
Yeah,
and the week before, he was asked to play left back against Arsenal. Jovinho was playing on the wing, so he was asked to mark. And he did all right. Newcastle drew nils each in that game, and then he went into the Sunderland match, and it was the second time ever. It was also his first taste of starting a Weir Tyne derby, as it was. So it was for him such a bizarre experience, out of position in many ways. He was that utility man for Newcastle, ended up playing so many different positions, and then getting the free kick, and he saw that there was just such a huge gap to go to, and he was tempted to see it. But
yeah,
the celebration that Stephen Taylor puts in, he thinks that Stephen Taylor's actually got a nick on
the way
that he celebrates.
I actually thought that as well in the game. And I mean, you know, Stephen Taylor would celebrate if he's been finished a word search, wouldn't he? He's that kind of person. But I remember that vividly. I remember the ball hitting the back of the net, and then I remember chaos, and then I remember seeing Stephen Taylor wheeling away with his arm in the air and just presuming he had scored, but obviously not. It was Ryan Taylor's goal. I think we can actually hear from Ryan now a little bit about that moment.
It was my first taste of a derby. I'd never been involved in one against Sunderland, so you know, for it to be away at the Stadium of Light, you know, it was hostile. The fans weren't, let's say, nice when we got off the bus. And I think that's where it sort of hits you as a player. You get off the bus and you see the, you know, the Sunderland fans have made a big effort to try and obviously upset you as soon as you get off the bus and give you some abuse. And I imagine it's, you know, the opposite way around when, you know, you're a Sunderland player getting off the bus underneath the tunnel at St James's. So, yeah, obviously you get a little bit pumped up just off that little walk, to be honest. And then, you know, you're getting ready for the game. We hadn't had a bad result the week before against Arsenal. And obviously, I filled in at left back because Jose went. So you know, if you like, I wasn't expected to play well, score goals at left back. I was just in there to fill until someone had signed, really, because I wasn't a left back. I remember Jonas winning a free kick in a good position, to be honest, in a position that I'd scored a couple in my time, especially when I was at Wigan in an area. You know, I'd scored in before, so I know exactly where to aim, what to do. And yeah, I actually remember watching the goalkeeper's position, because he didn't half leave that big gap. I mean, bigger than normal. It was just saying, go on, put it there. And yeah, I still think Stephen Taylor still tries to claim it to the day, but, you know, unlucky for him, we're a couple of years down the line now, and it's definitely my goal. I knew he could have nicked it, but at the time, I didn't really care, obviously, if he did or he didn't. I'd either set up a goal or I'd scored a goal, and we're winning in the enemy's backyard, if you like. So, yeah, still to the day, every time I watch it, he makes me laugh because he runs off like he's just scored an overhead kick in a World Cup final. Well, that was tails all over. He obviously, you know, he wanted to win more than anyone against Sunderland.
Over time, it's become for you that iconic moment. How long did it take before you realised the sort of magnitude amongst Newcastle fans of you scoring that goal? Was it quick that you suddenly realised that it had really been taken to heart?
It was fairly quick, yeah. Obviously, I didn't realise straight away because I hadn't been in that position before, or I hadn't really been around anyone who'd done that in the past, you know. And you struggled, obviously, when you were going to the games, you could still hear the O'Brien songs and everything else. But, you know, and then all of a sudden you do what, if you like, what they've done in the past and you get a song. But it was only a couple of days later we played Scunthorpe in the League Cup and we were losing 1-0, you know, 82nd minute or something. We get a free kick, stick that in the top corner and you just think, you know, that then you get a song and... Everywhere you were going, then it was, you know, Taylor, can I buy you a drink? And Taylor, can I do what? Can I, you know, can I do something for you? And then you start thinking, geez, it was quite big actually, like, you know, and what it meant was way beyond what I thought. You know, I knew obviously it'd mean a lot, but then until you actually do score the winner, and then you realise how much it actually means and what it means.
Did I read that after the game that you had a pizza dedicated to yourself, whereas usually you would get a single pizza? I think I read this a few years ago. That
No. What happened after that game was like any other game, really. We were playing, and there would be a couple of pizzas on the bus just to throw a bit of carbs back in you, and until you have a proper meal. So we got back on the bus and. Instead of there being just a big load of pizzas stacked up, you know, there was them all stacked up, and then a special delivery was one for me. And I can't even remember what was on it, but it was just like the chef had actually wrote in the box like some nice words to me, yeah, like, you know, like thank you and stuff like that. That's when I was like, all right, maybe, you know, getting a special pizza for scoring the winner. That's a nice little touch.
I can't remember who it was who nearly scored towards the end, but there was nearly another goal as well. I mean, obviously that would be nice and comfortable, but in some ways, I suppose that almost cements your sort of position in that circle because it wasn't the second.
It wouldn't be as well known if it was 2-0. But yeah, I remember it was Dan Gosling who had the chance, went through 1-on-1, and I think the goalie saved it, but. Obviously, after the game, you made up. You've still won. I wasn't gutted that he'd missed, but you know it could have been a lot easier them last final few minutes. But yeah, I always think, well, if he did score that, what would things have changed a bit more? I don't know, but you know, I'm thankful he missed in the end.
Do you remember when the fan got you to hold the picture of the SMB thing? Can you just explain how that sort of came about when you were in the car with the...
To be honest, every day after training, you'd always have kids there or people ask you to sign stuff at the training ground entrance. And just one day, this kid was just like, oh, can you hold this piece of paper? And before you know it, I was having a picture took. But it's not, I love, like, you know, I'm a Newcastle player. I'm all up for the banter against the enemies and stuff like that. I won't shy away from it. It's just, you know, there's no hard feelings. It's just, you know, it's football banter. Would I hold it up again? Yeah, would you? Because at the end of the day, it's a bit of fun. I'm sure, you know, the stick I get on social media from Sunderland fans, am I supposed to, you know, report these people for giving me a bit of football banter? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You give it, you take it. You give it, you take it. It's just one of them.
so lovely to hear Ryan reminiscing about those moments there, and what a goal that was, and also I think Ryan Taylor, Michael, you know a little bit about him, and he was a great servant of Newcastle, and probably quite underrated as a player, wasn't he? A bit of a Swiss Army knife player.
He was, yeah, utility, yeah. Whenever he was signed, that kind of it was seen as a sign. I remember it was seen as a sign of where the club were going, or where they, you know. Downwards in terms of, you know, this wasn't Patrick Kluivert, you know, this wasn't Michael Owen, you know, this was signing someone from Wigan, but actually Wigan were pretty good then, and I saw a fair amount of Wigan, you know, at that time, and he was really good, and he was very clean, you know, he was clean the way he passed the ball and the way he struck it, and his free kicks obviously were proof of that. And he was smart. I mean, just him saying there that he was Mignolet in goal, wasn't it? He saw Mignolet, you know, in this huge gap. And when you see the goal again, you sort of, that's the first thing I thought. Well, the first thing I thought was, why is Stephen Taylor celebrating as if he scored it? And then the second thing was, why is there so much space? And is Mignolet 4'6"? You know, it's just like he really small in the frame of the goal.
If you watch the replay of the goal as well, Mignolet takes a tiny little step to his right just as the ball's hit, and he actually opens that space up even more. I think he's waiting for the whip over the wall into that near corner, you know, and he just takes a step. And as he takes that step, he's done. As soon as he's took that step, there's no chance of him getting anywhere near that ball. But an incredible moment. And Chris, I was trying to think back about this game, and I couldn't honestly think of anything else that happened in the entire match. I don't remember it being a particularly great game of football. I know Phil Bardsley was sent off for a second yellow card. That's one of the only things I know about the game. I know Johan Cabaye possibly could have been sent off for a tackle on Phil Bardsley, and Seb Larson should have been sent off for a handball on the line from a Joey Barton header. But apart from those little tiny bits of memories, I don't really have a great memory of the game.
No, it wasn't that the Ryan Taylor, in terms of specifics beyond the goal, beyond Gosling missing and beyond the potential handball on the line, he couldn't remember many specifics. I mean, he said that it was the occasion that sort of gets the better of you, and that because it was, and it was a scrappy game. I mean, he put in one tackle at one stage and got booked, and it was a typical sort of derby tackle where it was about 5 minutes after the ball had been passed on, and he just slid in and sort of in front of the away fans. So it wasn't a particularly great game. It was a cagey affair. So it was only second game of the season. So it was an important game for both teams in terms of where they were going to be heading that season. And they ended up going sort of different ways. Obviously, Newcastle built from that, the positive momentum, the start of the season, and went on to finish fifth that year, whereas Sunderland had far more of a struggle throughout that season. So I think that the proximity to the start of the season, coupled with the actual magnitude of sort of we are tying derbies, really did impact on the game, and the game itself was poor, and that's part of the reason why one moment of brilliance is remembered so much, because it was in stark contrast to the rest of the game, really.
There's a lot of angst in those games. There's not much
points. I hate them. I absolutely hate them. I hate the derbies. I can't stand them. And being in the away end that day as well, the kind of the release when that ball hits the net it's unbelievable. I mean, it's chaos. You fall. I mean, I cut my shin open. I was nearly choked out by Mark Corby, who was sat next to me, stood next to me, should I say. But then everyone in unison turns to the Sunderland fans and flicks the V's and show them, waves the signs and all that. And it's those moments that I remember as a football fan. You know, I couldn't really tell you anything else that happened in the game, but I'll never forget that moment when that ball hit the net. It was absolutely amazing.
Michael, as someone obviously not from the Northeast, what is it like as witnessing the sort of game? Because obviously you've obviously done a lot of Old Firm games and other things like that. What is the time Weir or Weir Town Derby like?
I was going to say it seems like there's an increasing animosity, but actually the animosity may have always been there and I just didn't notice it as much. Yeah. You know, you it is really vitriolic and unpleasant. It probably is unpleasant, actually. You know, whenever you go to Ibrox and Celtic run out, I mean, that is unpleasant. You know, like, it's really, really unpleasant. And, you know, it's not on that level, but it's close. You know, it's close to that kind of, there's an electricity, isn't there? There's that kind of, as you say, that you hate it.
Like,
loads of fans hate it. Loads of fans hate it because of the feeling in their gut that morning, on the morning and in the days building up to it, is so strong. So they hate it. And then there's obviously the big release, if you will. Yeah. And then there's the massive depression if you lose. You know, that kind of, so it has a really disproportionate effect on you, doesn't it? You know,
it does.
So it's pretty wild, like.
It really is. And I mean, I think it's quite hard to describe the feeling to in sort of comparison to a normal Premier League game, where, you know, you might be disappointed if you lose a game, or you might even get a bit angry if you lose in the last few minutes. But it almost feels like there's so much riding on those derbies, even though in the grand scheme of things, let's be honest, they're not particularly important, are they, when it comes to the kind of final positions in the league and all that sort of stuff. They haven't been for a long time. The relevance of them is very much in our own heads, isn't it? And I remember there was a derby game at St James's Park where I think it was Nicholas Bentner scored They scored the penalty, and Shola Amiobi scored an equaliser in the last minute at the Gallagher end. And I remember walking down the I remember walking down the steps, and I could feel my heart pounding in my chest, and I had to stop. I had to stop walking and take a moment and catch my breath. And I thought, it's not worth this, is it? It's not. There's just no need for this.
Not good for you, that. That's not healthy, is it?
It's not.
Can you imagine what it's like being a manager?
Oh, God, I know. And I mean, we're going to get onto that soon, aren't we? But there we go. I mean, Ryan Taylor gets iconic status for the goal and for that moment. And Ryan Taylor, Over the Wall song is born. While the fans are locked in the away end, waiting to be escorted back to the coaches and home to Tyneside for a blurry evening of celebrations. And that's exactly what it was. It was a great night and a great day. And I remember vividly, and I don't condone this kind of behaviour, but I did find it funny at the time. I was stood in a bar in Newcastle City Centre that night, and somebody came over to me and said, "Would you like to buy a seat from the Stadium of Light?" And opened his jacket to show me the back of a seat that he had taken home with him, which I thought was, I don't condone that, but I thought it was hilarious. Well, there we go. As Chris said earlier, that Ryan Taylor interview is part of a series of Cult Hero articles over the next few weeks throughout The Athletic, not just on with Newcastle. Keep your eyes peeled on the app or the website for plenty of great memories from all our dedicated teams. We're going to be back in 2 seconds just after this.
Hello, listeners. Sorry to interrupt your show, but we've got a small favour to ask. We're currently doing a bit of a survey to find out more about you, your podcast listening habits, and the sort of adverts that are most relevant to you. If you feel like helping, please head to surveymonkey.com/r/athleticaudiouk. That's pretty catchy, so I'll say it one more time. surveymonkey.com/r/athleticaudiouk. Thank you.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. Shopify.com/theathletic.
Right. So, lastly, the big topic, really, that's on everybody's lips at the minute, and it seems to be a hot debate amongst the pundits and the fans all up and down the country. Why hasn't Steve Bruce been sacked yet? That is the question that we're asking. In my opinion, from what I've seen this season, there's been a few times when Steve Bruce could have been sacked. Brentford away stands out in the mind, Sheffield United, and of course, the game against Brighton at the weekend. By every single metric that you can measure football by, Newcastle are quite comfortably an appalling football team. And with Premier League managers with more than 250 games under the belt, only two have win percentages of less than 30%, one of them being Steve Bruce and the other being Brian Robson. Chris, why hasn't Steve Bruce been sacked yet? What is going on?
I mean, it's a very good question. And as I said, when George and I wrote the piece on sort of Saturday night, it did feel like the end, and it felt like it should have been the end. And I still think it should have been the end. I think in many ways it felt like his position had become untenable. I think that even from his pronouncements, I think he almost accepted that. He gave an interesting phrase when he said that I have to accept the consequences. He said that after the game, and I think that my understanding is that the players, at least initially, thought that he may have been sacked there and then. And then I think that they were surprised because I think they thought that then it'll happen in the coming days, and it obviously hasn't. Newcastle, unusually for them, or sources close to the club, were keen to get information out on Sunday morning that he wasn't going to be sacked. They wanted to sort of end any speculation about that, rather than it continue over the course of the international break. There was quite offensive language used, I saw, in many ways. That I know a lot of Newcastle fans were insulted by it anyway, the idea that of loyalty towards Steve Bruce from Mike Ashley, which basically seems like more of a fealty rather than loyalty sort of thing. And what exactly that means, I don't really know. He's been manager for 20 months. I don't really understand what exactly that means. But also, I think that there is a lot of sympathy still within the club about the effects of COVID that had on the club. I think some players still are suffering from those after effects, obviously the injuries as well. And the idea that Newcastle, well, I think basically if Fulham had won on Friday night, I think Bruce, there's a far better chance of Bruce would have been gone. If Newcastle were in the bottom three, I think that there's a higher chance of Bruce would have gone. But Newcastle, as they seem to do quite often under Mike Ashley, are going against seemingly what the vast majority of fans want, which is they want a change. They think that without a change, then it's seemingly inevitable that Newcastle will go down. Newcastle in the past have twice changed managers and ended up going down anyway. I would say that view and things, as it seems to be internally in the club, is a slight revisionism of history, because I don't think that's exactly what happened. I think in many ways it was because the change came too soon, but also actually certainly under Benitez, there was a massive uplift in the way the team played, and they had just ran out of time in the end. So I can't really answer your question with an answer which anyone is going to want to hear. It's just various reasons there, yeah. And seemingly Newcastle just don't want to make that change. And Steve Bruce, as things stand, is going to be in the dugout for the Spurs game.
Michael, from your point of view and in your experience, why do you think Steve Bruce hasn't gone yet? I mean, from a devil's advocate point of view, what might be the thinking behind keeping Bruce in position?
Well, as I said before, I think if there is a strategy, then they may have looked at the remaining games and thought we can get 6 or 7 points, and that might be enough. So they may, you know, and they may have had a conversation with Bruce, which has sort of emphasised that. And he said, look, you know, we'll rejig the formation. We'll be able to, you know, dig out 6 points, whatever, you know, that. I don't know if that conversation has gone on, of course. But I think, as a neutral, the question is it's not for me to say whether someone should or shouldn't be sacked. But the key word is the situation tenable? Is his relationship with the dressing room tenable? Do they view him as someone they respect who can get them out of this situation? Are the players really desperate to do that? Are they being motivated by him, or are they going through the motions? These are questions that the, at the top of the club, they need to be asking themselves. And then they have to ask themselves, do they have a viable alternative who will be able to motivate players and get the necessary improvement in performances? I think more broadly across football, there's something else that's going on, and that is about the structure of your club and how you play. And Newcastle are not flattered by comparisons with Brighton. They're not flattered with comparisons with Fulham, never mind Leeds or anything like that. And Bruce is not flattered by comparisons with Parker or Potter, never mind Bielsa. So you've got, so from your fan base perspective, there's so little to cling on to. You can't see an overall strategy. You can't see a work in progress, and you can't see victories being dug out. So you might be able to accept one of, you know, you might be able to accept the last of those if it was happening at the expense of the previous two. But I just think that football fans are far too smart and actually know and understand the club, which is why 10,000 of them walked away from Newcastle. You know, so that's the fact, you know, because they understand, they can see what's going on. They can see the gradual degeneration of the club. Now, obviously the focus falls upon Steve Bruce as the manager because of performances such as West Brom away, which was really, you know, I think was worse than Brighton away. So it becomes very difficult for the fan base to believe in anything.
It does. I mean, and also the fans have been frustrated recently by different sound bites coming out of the broadcast media. But there's almost been a bit of a change in tone, Chris, hasn't it, over the last couple of weeks? Jeff Stelling, for one, was somebody who put a tweet out on the 20th of March. Okay, Newcastle fans, please don't hammer me. But now I think I understand. And it feels like a sort of tide change of opinion from the broadcast media over what Newcastle fans have been saying for a long time and have been roundly accused of being delusional or expecting too much. Now I think people are coming around to it and understanding where we've been coming from all this time.
Yeah, well, I always find this is a bit of an issue. I suppose I'd use the example almost in reverse of Arsenal, because every time I watch Arsenal, and I don't watch every single one of the games, but every time I watch them, I'm always quite underwhelmed. And yet there seems to be at least a portion of Arsenal fans who love the fact that Arteta's there and think he's doing a good job and could see the way the team's heading. And I always think, right, well, I need to listen to what they have to say, because they watch Arsenal every week. They're consumed by it. They see all of what goes on. And I think that the frustration that a lot of Newcastle fans have, and that I've had listening to some pundits over the period of time, is that they just look at the league table, and particularly after the Sheffield United game, looked at it and said, oh, well, the 10 points clear the relegation zone. What is the issue here? And it's that it's been heading in this direction for so long. And as Michael says, there's been nothing to cling on to think this is what Newcastle United are building towards. And yeah, I think more people are now seeing that now. Newcastle are in this perilous position now that you see the Brighton performance, as Michael says, wasn't a one-off. That was what's more shocking about it. It wasn't a one-off. There's been five or six of those this season. There's been Brentford away. There's been Sheffield United. There's been West Brom. There's been Newport. There's been Brighton at home. There's been so many games like that. And I think that when Michael talks about, is it tenable? That's where I'd come to as well. I wouldn't advocate necessarily saying that anyone should be sacked or anything like that. But when I look at Steve Bruce's position now, and I'm writing a column about this at the minute, which will be up tomorrow, and sort of explain the situation this week, but also sort of looking forward, is I can't see a scenario where Steve Bruce is manager come the start of next season, because if Newcastle go down, I know that there's been some pundits who suggested, well, who would you want more than Steve Bruce to be the manager? But the situation that they've got themselves in and the disconnect that there now is, from my understanding, with at least some people in the dressing room, to be able to bounce back at the first time of asking, you're going to need to galvanise a squad. You're going to need to create unity. So I can't see how he's there in that scenario. Even if they're scraped to survival, I then go to that Michael mentioning that 10,000 fans already weren't going to the stadium. Newcastle have also already had a full year, or it will be more than a full year, of not having had fans in ground. So they've lost the money from behind closed doors games. How are you going to encourage supporters to come back in the start of the new season if the vision is Steve Bruce is still there and you're going to have more of the same? And so that's why I think it's got to a position where it feels like it's the long goodbye. And it feels to me as if between some point between now and the start of next season, Steve Bruce will go. But I can't at the minute comprehend that. Now, it's Mike Ashley's Newcastle and anything could happen. And it could well be that he is still here. But when I put all those factors into one situation, I can't see a scenario where he can still, in theory, be there, given all of those factors I've just mentioned.
Is it a big Mike Ashley gamble, Michael, on Newcastle staying up and potentially being taken over in the summer? Is that the thinking here? Is it just a game to him?
Trying to second guess Mike Ashley is, well, has been proven.
Should know better than ask that question, really, shouldn't I?
Yeah, has been proven impossible in the past. So yeah, but he does. Yeah. He does like a gamble. He likes the idea of a gamble. He likes the idea of being a maverick. He likes this impression of himself. But the fact is that you to run a football club, you have to have a strategy and a structure. I'm sorry if that sounds boring, but that's what you need.
And increasingly
in modern football, that's what you need. It's clubs are so much bigger now. It isn't just about, you know, picking 11 and going out there. Everything stems from the pitch. That's first and foremost. I agree with that. But you have to have a broader structure. So, and Newcastle haven't had it for ages. You go back to McLaren's departure. You know, it went on for days and days and days. You know, so whenever Chris says about a long goodbye, you know they've already had one. And the only reason it was ended when it was ended was because Rafa Benitez made himself available. They did not go and chase Rafa Benitez. He made himself available. So if he hadn't done that, what would have happened? And I think in the situation we are now, that may be the case. Who is a viable alternative to take the top? Graham Jones?
Well, I mean, it's with the greatest respect to Graham Jones. He doesn't exactly inspire confidence in with his appointment, does he? I mean, maybe till the end of the season, but it's not the bigger picture, is it, really? I mean, there's fans have talked about Eddie Howe, have spoken about other managers, but which sort of ambitious, young, progressive manager would want to come and work under this structure, under this regime?
It's, and Mike Ashley's never gone for an appointment like that, though, either.
No, he hasn't. That's true. I mean, it's more likely to be Mark Hughes, isn't it, or Tim Sherwood or somebody like that, than it is to be anyone else.
The one thing we know is Mike Ashley does not want this football club run from the dugout.
Yeah.
That's why Rafa Benitez isn't there. That's why Kevin Keegan isn't there. That's why Alan Shearer isn't there, because he doesn't want it run from the dugout. He wants it run from the boardroom, which he controls. So whoever comes in has to work within those parameters. And if you were being generous to Steve Bruce, you would say, well, he actually understood that. He understood that in a way that Rafa Benitez didn't, you know, because Rafa Benitez tried to win Ashley over and he just couldn't. And it was never going to happen. Whereas Bruce sort of knows
in the game, isn't he?
The hierarchy. Yeah. And knows,
yeah,
and knows his role in it. And actually, that meant he was able to sign Wilson Fraser and Jamal Lewis last summer, which were good signings, which were solid signings. Everyone agreed at the time. That was probably Steve Bruce's high point that moment whenever he signed those players, because it looked as if he had won an argument upstairs rather than, you know, influencing people downstairs. And that is what everyone has to remember, is that Mike Ashley won't want. So Eddie Howe, I can't see Eddie Howe coming in, because as soon as someone explains this to him, he'll just go, well, I don't want that. I want to work within a club that's got a strategy and has a 2, 3, 4, 5-year plan.
Well, chaps, we're going to wrap it up. Michael, thank you so much for coming on and sitting in for George this week. It's been an absolute pleasure having you, mate. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed.
No problem at all. And thanks for listening. With it being International Week, there's no game to preview. And the blessed relief is we won't have to pick the bones out of another West Brom or Brighton debacle next week. Instead, we're going to be doing an AMA, AMA, or should that be an AUA? Ask us anything. Whatever you want to call it, we'll be fielding your questions. So please make them good. And we at least want some positive ones to chew over. If you want to ask us anything at all, you can give myself, George and Chris a shout on Twitter using the hashtag PodOnTheTyne. My handle is at TaylorAndPayne. Chris is at ChrisDHWoff. I had to think about that there. And George is at George Corgan. As always, please remember to hit subscribe so that you don't miss a show. Leave us a review and a rating if you're feeling particularly generous. And we'll be back next week with another Pod on the Tyne. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Message Perchy yesterday, who I interviewed last year, just to ask him if he had any questions. Yeah. You want to be yes. So I want to go some of the other Newcastle period in a little bit. But first of all, so he says, can you ask him about what happened in Portugal when we were playing Benfica and me, Taylor, and Gosling were playing FIFA?
I can't believe he's brought that up. No, I didn't think this would ever get out. But I can't believe he's asked you. Yeah, so no, me and my girls were quite, we were really good friends. We were around each other's houses and all our girlfriends and wives got on really well. Kids and everything, similar ages. So we got on really well. So we played FIFA a lot. And, you know, we used to have a couple of quid on it per game and stuff like that. And, you know, sometimes just go up and down, but I wasn't even supposed to be in Benfica because I was injured. But but Pard took me because he wanted me to be involved, because I was nearly back to getting fit again. So you know, I went out there, done a bit of training with the team, I'd done a lot of running with the physio. So and then I got to watch the game, but yeah, the night before I think it was. So we're playing FIFA, and the two of them used to get under my skin so bad. I'd love to just play out from the back on FIFA and like make them just run a lot, but they'd win the ball off me, and then 9 times out of 10 they'd score. And they used to always say, "He'll give you a chance. He'll give you a chance." Like, and it wound me up. So playing in Benfica, I gave a goal away. Two of them are stood there. One's playing me, the other one, and they're both like, "He'll give you a chance." And I just got up, and I just punched the telly and the telly just shattered. I was like, oh no. And then I ended up having to cough up way more than what the telly cost, for sure, because they just added probably about 4 tellies on top of what I ended up paying for it. Yeah, but I had to cough up for a new telly. Yeah, in the hotel I had a moment of rage, let me tell you. It was down to them two just winding me up.
The Athletic.